And because they're locked to the exact same satellite in the zero hertz between the two, you wouldn't be able to use that as a differentiator, as a discriminant. Now the poor converter is listening to the actual data that's on that 6 meg bandwidth, and it's either getting two streams of data or one stream of data, depending on how well your antenna is aimed. So here's my last question. Have you ever run into the circumstance when you heard no beat note, meaning that either you've tuned out the bad guy by antenna aiming, you've nulled out the bad guy, and you still had plenty of amplitude of the pilot tone, and yet the digital converter said, I don't see it? Have you ever run into that circumstance, Joe? Go ahead.
I'll give you something close to that. I've had an occasion where channel 21 was taken out. Could not get channel 21 unless I actually aimed my antenna precisely at the transmitter, even slightly north of it. Whatever was coming in that was co-channel, and it sounded like it was on the same frequency as far as I could tell. It must have been coming from somewhere in the south, southwest of me, maybe at a bearing 240, 250, something like that. It was strong enough to completely take out channel 2, and my normally the antenna like about 270, 275 for bearing to get the best from New York. I think it's actually supposed to be 284, but 270, 275 works fine. Normally, I get channel 21, full bars, no problem. And I use an Insignia converter, so I'm not sure what you're using. I'll tell you something of what that has an advantage of in a moment for TV DXing, hounds like you would like to be. But I couldn't identify the other station. I tried to turn the antenna off channel 21, and I could not identify the other interference. But with the breakup of the picture and looking at the bit error meter going from, say, 50% to 40 to 30 and changing, going as high as 70 at one particular azimuth setting, I knew there was something else behind it that the TV converter was not happy with, didn't like. Couldn't identify what else it was, but I seem to get like a stronger signal and make channel, and 21 did disappear as I put the antenna to about 235 to 245. And I got a, fairly strong indicated signal as far as in signal strength, but not enough to make the bit error rate meter lock up. Now, let me tell you something that's nice with the Insignia converter I use, which is the same thing as the Zenith DT901. If you leave that in the mode where you do not shut the converter off, you leave it on all the time. If you leave that on an RF channel, if it sees something, eventually it will display the header information, and even if the signal comes and goes for a brief amount of time, it'll retain that header information. So you will have like a stamp of, I received something on this particular channel sometime throughout the day. Now, I backed that out by having that happen at least once or twice by using a VCR and recording about 8 hours worth of tape on a particular channel and just watching. When I get a picture, that pretty much convinces me I got something, and the header information can pretty much confirms what I got at that particular time. So that's one good advantage I found with the Insignia converters.
Yeah, whenever I demand what I call header information out of the converter I own, Radio Shack, it'll go there for a certain number of seconds, 30 seconds or whatever, and then it discontinues it. I think you're saying your Insignia converter will allow you to request header information, channel number, start time, stop time, a particular program or whatever, and you can demand it, it'll stay there, and you can make a continuous video cassette recording of that, is what I think you're saying. I don't think I've got that capability. I'll have to build some kind of a circuit that keeps pressing that button periodically. Over to you. My mind's going blank. You got it, Joe.
The Insignia converter will, if you put it into the manual mode, like you're going to change the channel, and you just leave it on a particular channel, it times out after 60 seconds. And then it gives you a display on the video output, or RF output of the converter, of no signal. That's okay. That means it does not receive a signal. That's fine. But if you leave it sit there, eventually something will come in and it will try to lock up on whatever comes in on that particular frequency when it's in the manual mode. And you can leave it on a manual channel all day long or all night long if you want, and it will, you know, retain the last header information, the last thing it saw on that frequency.
Okay. I think you're saying this is the manual selection of a channel. I can do a scan, and if the channel is present, it'll put it on the list. I can demand it to go to a particular channel. It won't put it on the list, but yes, it will stay on the frequency that I demand. Aha. So you're telling me I may be able to demand it to go to a particular RF frequency, simultaneously demand header information, and then it's going to record header when that channel pops onto that frequency? Over to you, Joe.
Well, what you're going to get from the output of the converter when it starts trying to decipher a picture, you're going to get a picture that it's a pixelated type of picture. It'll come, it'll go, and if the signal strength is strong enough where the thing can completely decode what it wants to see, you'll be happy and you'll get a complete picture. That's what I've done already. With the station from, say, North Platte, Nebraska, because I picked up strong signals on there where the signal strength meter will go up to sometimes 30%, but it will not display header information, so it's probably just not quite strong enough to make the converter work properly. I've left it in that condition in the manual mode for, say, an 8-hour clip. I'll start the VCR, auto-start the VCR with a tape and let it go in the 8-hour record mode and just record away. If it sees something, it sees something, and that tells me, okay, I got something at a particular time, and when I when I come back and look at the converter later on, it'll have the header information retained on that particular channel. Once I don't change it, it's there. I can copy it down and go look it up to find out what I'm looking at. That's what I'm telling you. So, yes, you can leave it in the manual mode if your unit does that. It sounds like it's yours is probably similar to the Insignia brand, because I think Radio Shack sells the Zenith, and I think that's basically made by the same company. So, yeah, it does the same thing, Dick.
Real fun. Okay, I got some more capability there than I know about. I've been talking about this for a long time now. I'm going to go out and do it one of these days. Thank you, Joe. As you can tell, Joe does digital television DXing, and he's going out to Toledo, Ohio, North Platte, Nebraska, down to North Carolina, and so up to Boston. There's stuff out there. And I could put a significant antenna on top of 100 feet of tower and start really doing some work. Do you have any emails you think we should try to answer, Mel? K2KEY, K2RIW on the TechNet.
Okay, this is K2KEY. First of all, the copy old better, I put the amp on.
You sound a lot closer to dead full quieting. You were 20% noise before, looking beautiful. And just give us enough audio and you got it made.
Okay, this is K2KEY. All right. Very interesting. Let's see. I had a lot of emails to read over. All right, let me pick some interesting ones. Okay, here's one. We generated a lot of interest in that vertical antenna experiment a few weeks ago, if you remember. You know, we talked about these verticals and these little pricey pipes that they're selling with some kind of matching networks on the bottom, and people wanted to do the experiment of trying something like this for a fraction of the cost. So our suggestion on how to go about it, how to make the L networks and all to work, seem to have generated a lot of interest. A lot of people have had a lot of fun doing this. And some of the questions that have come off of that, I see one here that has been repeated a few times. What effect does tapering, you had mentioned that the experiment done by Jerry Civic was using 10 foot of TV mast with an 8 foot of stainless steel whip. What effect does this have, this tapering effect, and how much do we figure that in into the process. Over.
Yeah, when it comes to the word tapering, I think there's at least two meanings here. I think there's the equivalent of electronic tapering by where you put the loading coils, how many of them, and how they're tuned. But when it comes to mechanical tapering, in other words, for mechanical reasons, you might be thinking about making the bottom of the mast, let me pick a number, 3 inches in diameter, and the middle of the mast, 2 inches diameter, the top of the mast, 1 inch diameter, that kind of jazz, mechanical tapering. And I think the difference in bandwidth and frequency tuning and whatever you get from mechanical tapering is a second-order effect, is my first guess. See, as a as an occupation, I've worked on lots of antennas where I use extremely wide pieces of copper for Yagi-like elements at UHF frequencies. I'm talking about making an element 5 or 10% of a wavelength wide. Well, if you made an antenna 10% wide of a wavelength on, let me pick a number, 40 meters, where the wavelength is 130 feet, that means the mast would be 13 feet in diameter. Nobody you and I know is likely to do that. You go to numbers like 5 and 10% of diameter in wavelengths. Let me drop. You do that, you do get significant broadbanding of the antenna. But for the frequencies of HF, you don't have to really, in the case of dipole-like structures, you can fool the RF. You can use what's called a cage structure. In other words, your one wire of, let's say, a 40-meter dipole really consists of 6 wires that are suspended on a hexagon-like spacer. So you're building a cage. Electronically, the radio wave going down those 6 wires will think that it is a piece of tubing that's a foot in diameter. In reality, it's just 6 wires with a 1 foot diameter of the spacing of the 6 wires on the disc that they're mounted on. So when it comes to a vertical mast, my first gut feel on this one, Mel, is you're doing the tapering for mechanical reasons. I don't think there's a substantial difference in frequency bandwidth characteristics. Now, there's another catch to that. Some of those antennas do use some kind of a crazy feed line structure that is shoved down that tubing, and it loops back and forth as an impedance matching structure. That's more than tapering. Let's put it inside of a shielded structure that is the radiator. I wonder how much of this has been able to experiment with, Mel. K2KEY, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Okay, this is K2KEY. No, it just refers to the factor that most of the people that are doing the experiment, as we suggested, have picked up a couple of pieces of pipe, conduit or whatever, and it's been pieces of different, not specifically how Jerry Civic did it, with a piece of television pipe, which is about 1¼-inch pipe, and putting a stainless steel whip that tapered really down to very, very small point, you know, as I guess a stainless steel whip does come down to a very small area at the top. So they were interested in the factor, basically how it changes the resistance and the reactance, how much of a factor you, because the chart that I had referred them to usually tell you that if you have a piece of pipe of so-and-so length with a so-and-so diameter, it will exhibit so many ohms resistance, so many ohms of capacitive reactance. So they wonder if they deviate from those, like for instance, they'll give you a standard size pipe, you know, considering that you will be using, say, I'd say 20 feet to 1¼-inch pieces of pipe. What happens if you taper it, Dick? Over.
WJ2B with a question. WJ2B, recognized. WJ2B. You get a little bit of a clue about what happens with diameter of a radiator versus the resistive component and reactive component by going to those curves that I refer to quite often called the Brown and Woodward curves. chapter 4 of almost every issue of the Antenna Engineering Handbook, except the very first edition, 1961. There it was chapter 3. And you can also go to that website of Whiskey Alpha 1, Mike Bravo Alpha, .org. At the bottom of his page, you'll find the K2RIW dipole information and Yagi and dipole information, and there you'll see these Brown and Woodward curves. The curve changes very slowly as you go from 1,000 to 1 diameter to length ratio to 500 to 250 and so on, until you get down to 4, which would be 25% bandwidth of a quarter wave radiator, which would be what? 5%. Until you get down to numbers like 5% of a wavelength in diameter, you don't get a huge change in either the resistive component or the reactive component. So, again, for the kinds of diameters and the wavelengths, let me drop, that you and I are likely, or our friends are likely to experiment with, Mel, until you start getting into caged radiators and caged dipoles, where you can really make some number of percent of wavelength of electronic diameter, until you get there, I don't think very much happens. So if the whole length was that diameter, it changes slowly. Therefore, if you're tapering it where only portions of it are that diameter, I still think it's going to change slowly. I just don't think that that method of construction is going to give you a huge advantage. Again, I'm of the opinion you choose the diameter for mechanical reasons more than electronic reasons. But I haven't really done it. I'm telling you what my experience is at UHF frequencies, and I think that's going to carry over to VHF frequencies. Whiskey Juliet 2 Bravo. Please start off with your name, sir, and then your question or comment. I'm K2RIW. My name is Dick.
Okay, good evening, Dick. The name here is Joe Juliet Oscar Echo, who calls Whiskey Juliet 2 Bravo. Being that you're on the subject of antennas, I just started listening about 45 minutes ago, and I was just curious if you guys had any inside info on the Apple iPhone 4 antenna malfunction that they've been talking about in the newspapers, about if you hold your hand near a certain area on the bottom of the phone, that it interferes with the operation of the built-in antenna, and also that the supposedly this new iPhone is better than the old 3GS as far as dropping calls and as far as antenna performance. So I was just curious if you had any inside scoop on what's going on with that fiasco there with the Apple. They say that if you buy a rubber glove for it and your hand doesn't touch the metal strip around the edge of the phone, that supposedly the antenna malfunction does not occur. So Apple suggested people buy a rubber glove for it. So I don't know if they're... And then the other day they said that the algorithm they use to calculate how many bars of signal strength they're receiving is also not working correctly, that they have to revisit that algorithm, that the bars are not showing the right amount or something like that. So I wonder if you guys had any insight info on that story there. Back over to you, Dick, WJTV.
Good question, Joe. And yes, I've been somewhat tracking that situation. I build antennas that have to be touched, and or at least a hand is nearby, and therefore I'm sort of aware of this problem. When Steve Jobs first gave his presentation of the new iPhone 4, and he talked about the geniuses that developed the antenna that has this notch in it and it goes around the perimeter of the iPhone 4, the audience cheered. When he actually went and demonstrated it, he thought that the number of laptops in the audience in operation was jamming up his local area network, and therefore that's the reason he wasn't able to, he was locked out of it, so to speak. And there were some people think that when they play that movie back, they see that he was holding it in the death grip mode, therefore his hand was on the antenna and giving the antenna grief. When you take a UHF, SHF antenna, UHF means 800 megacycles for wide area network, cell phone, or 1900, or or 2200, those frequencies that are used for cell phone. You take an antenna on that frequency where your hand becomes in direct contact with the metal. Your hand is an extremely good radio absorber. Radio-wise, you make a very good dummy load. And therefore, you're loading down the antenna, something fierce. You're sucking up the RF energy, turning it into heat in your hand, and you're detuning the antenna. So the transmitter inside the radio starts seeing an extremely high standing wave ratio. Anything you can do to space your hand from the antenna rapidly diminishes that property, but doesn't thoroughly remove it. By that rubber bumper you can buy for the iPhone 4, which spaces the hand, that definitely makes an improvement. The barcode problem, the bar indicator problem, when I play back some of those YouTube videos, and there's a zillion of them, of people showing what kind of performance they actually are getting, you can tell that the integration time he's got on his barcode display, he did admit the fact that there's an error in the barcode magnitude versus signal strength, and he's correcting that, but I can tell he's also integrating for a very long period of time. You can put your hand on the antenna so that you're interrupting the signal, but as you watch the barcode, you have to watch for about 5 or 10 seconds before they respond to the decrease in signal that you've just created. Let me drop. It's interesting to note that Steve gave his presentation for the breakthrough radio, the iPhone 4, I think it was on April 23rd, and that's when he tried to make the demonstration in a location, in an auditorium, which I believe is different than his development laboratory. In his development laboratory, AT&T has placed a cell phone base station very close to his laboratory. So any testing he did in his laboratory, he had a very nearby base station giving him a whopper of a signal, and he couldn't really see this effect. Whereas in the auditorium where he was giving his presentation, I think he wasn't anywhere near as close to the base station. That's a speculation on my part. Also interesting to note that on April 23rd, his organization issued a request for 3 high-power antenna engineers that he wants to hire to work on portable radio devices that have the ability to work in the presence of a human body nearby. You read the requirement for the 3 antenna engineers he wants to hire. And when you read the description, it's obvious that he wants improvement on the cell phone antenna. And it's overly coincidental that he issued the request for those 3 engineers on the exact same day that he gave the presentation. And according to Snopes and these other organizations that will tell you whether or not that request is a hoax or real, I believe those requests for antenna engineers appear to be real. Thought you'd sort of get a kick out of all of that, Joe. Whiskey Juliet 2 Bravo, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Yeah, it sounds like a very interesting coincidence there. But I know that they've, I know a few people that have the 3G and then upgraded to the 3GS, which I think was just the speed processing and some extra features and things like that, but didn't really help the antenna performance or the drop call problem too much. But I guess that AT&T has said that their network has been overloaded by the amount of people that are using the iPhone and other types of phones, for data streaming and listening to listening to like internet radio stations and really streaming a large amount of data, and it's really putting a burden on their network. So they're saying they're upping the performance in their network, and Apple is saying that the new 4G is upping the performance of the antenna, so you get less dropped calls. Because that's pretty much the major complaint I've heard from people that have the iPhone, is that you get dropped calls, I guess, in between in base stations. If you don't have if you don't have your hand in the right spot of the phone, you lose the signal before the next base station can take over, and you're in the fringe area of both of them, and then you wind up losing the call, and you have to get a dropped call. And I'm a Verizon person. I'm really waiting for for Verizon to to get a version of the iPhone. I still like the, I like the iPhone. I'd like to get one, but I don't really want to switch to AT&T as a carrier, so I'm waiting for Verizon to get some version of the iPhone, which supposedly the exclusivity agreement with AT&T is going to run out at the end of this year, so they're saying in January that next year they're supposedly going to have a Verizon version of the iPhone, which has been long awaited by a lot of Verizon, you know, diehard Verizon customers. So should be interesting.
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout.
You timed out the machine about a minute ago, Joe, but I heard everything you said on the input. You've got a Verizon carrier right now, and you do wish that iPhone 4 had a Verizon version. Right now it seems to be exclusive to AT&T. Is AT&T not one of your favorites because they don't have quite the amount of coverage where you live in Wisconsin? Or is it just a brand loyalty? You started off with Verizon, you'd like to stick with them. I wonder where you feel on that one. And beyond a minute and a half, you've got to drop the machine or it times out, Joe. WJ2B, K2RIW and the Tech Man.
Okay, sorry, I didn't realize that it was timed out on the, I thought it was in net mode, I guess not. All right, I pretty much don't have very good coverage where I am, either with Verizon or AT&T. Verizon is a bit better. I have a friend that has had AT&T, one of my wife's friends actually had AT&T about a block away, and they kept dropping calls constantly. Whenever they would make a call from inside their house, they would have a lot of problems. So Verizon has a little bit better coverage. I had a Verizon smartphone at one time that had internet on it, and I could hardly get any data coverage at all in my, inside my house. So I have Wi-Fi, you know, with my computer set up, so I don't really need it. But the coverage is very poor for AT&T and for Verizon over here in my particular area because there isn't really any base stations very close to my my area here. I guess they don't like putting, people don't want towers near their houses around here for some reason, but I guess it'll get better sooner or later. But yeah, I'm pretty much brand loyal to Verizon. I've always had, you know, good luck. Whenever I, you know, at the phone, I have about a four-year-old. Whenever I need to make a call, wherever I am, you know, wherever I've traveled to in the country, whenever I pick up that phone, I'm able to usually to make a call. Probably, I think 99 out of 100 times I've picked it up. But people with AT&T, I don't think have that kind of luck, as far as I've heard, you know, from what I've heard.
Okay, Joe and Wesley in that order. Joe, go right ahead. W-A-2-R-Y-Y, K-2-R-I-W and TechNet, you've got it, Joe.
1-2-3-4, can you hear me now?
I heard you beautifully before when you signed in. Go right ahead, Joe.
Yeah, well, I was trying to get in from the IRLP, and you guys kept on coming to us, and now I'm coming in on VHF. Can you let me pick it up on IRLP and be able to hear me without noise?
Okay, your choice, we'll stand by.
Okay, from working in the past on wireless communication systems for many, many years, AT&T used a GSM system. And I do know that on a GSM system, that signal strength bar on your phone is not indicating signal strength. It's indicating signal level above access threshold. And what that means is the base station receives you and it knows what signal strength you're coming in at, and it knows how to plot that and send back the information to you above how many dB you are above access threshold. Engineering has been known to move that level lower, and if they move the level lower, you get a larger antenna reading on your phone, but it's not received signal strength.
Interesting. So if I understand you correctly, Joe, people like me have up till now naively assumed that the number of bars indicated on a cell phone is the integrated output of a RSSI, receiver signal strength indicator. In other words, downlink signal strength into the client radio is what I thought it was. You seem to be telling me that it is an uplink signal strength indicator. how many decibels above threshold at the base station. That information, in turn, is being telemetered back to the client radio, and that's what's being displayed. That's what I think you've said. Turning it back to you, Joe, for a confirmation on that. K2RIW.
Okay, I'll give it to you in simple terms. Say they have the access threshold at a particular cell site set for, it's called a random access threshold, because if it was infinite, your phone would be trying to find the base station all the time. They set it at some predetermined level number, maybe like -108, -110, -112, something like that. It's not really too much lower than that. That is simply indicating your signal strength of how it sees you coming in above that particular number. If you're closer to the station, you'll get a higher reading. Say if your phone being received by the station is coming in at -98, and the access threshold is -108, so you're 10 dB above that, it'll display so many bars on your phone. It's not forward signal, it's reverse signal, how it sees you, not how you see it.
Okay. I call that the uplink. From the base station to the client radio, I call that the downlink. And from the client radio back to the base station, I call that the uplink. And that the base station threshold is set at 108, -108 dBm. And if my client radio in the uplink is giving a signal strength of -98, 10 dB stronger than -108, the base station makes a determination, sends that information back in the downlink data stream to the client radio, and the client radio displays its equivalent to a 10 dB signal-to-noise ratio. Is that what you're saying, Joe? Go ahead.
Yes, I am. And I do know what uplink and downlink mean, Dick.
How Verizon works that way?
Yeah, I was well aware that you know what uplink and downlink media meant, Joe. I wasn't saying it for your benefit. You and I are not the only people talking here tonight. What was your other question about Verizon? Somebody just asked. Go ahead.
The question is that it's a cell. It's not the base station, the nearest cell, but the...
Thank you for the correction in the vocabulary. Does sound right. Somebody asked about Verizon. Go ahead. Who was that?
Hey, Dick, it's Joe again, WJ2B. I was just curious if the other Joe knew if Verizon, with their CDMA system, works that same way, or is the phone actually showing received signal strength?
Yeah, let me reword Joe number two's question back to Joe number one. Joe number one is RYY. Joe number one, do you believe the cell-to-client downlink telemetry representing the number of bars, which really is decibels above set threshold at the cell, do you believe that each of the brand names, AT&T, Verizon, and so on, are they all doing it approximately that way? Back to you, Joe, number one. W-H-U-R-Y-Y, K-2-R-I-W.
Y-Y. I don't know how to do it on CDMA. I can ask somebody who works in that particular field and find out specifically how they do that. They'd probably have to contact one of their engineering people. That's how I found out how that particular feature happens to work, because I thought for a while that, yeah, I thought the thing reads downlink signal strength. It's not. It reads the uplink. But I can find that in that information. It may take me a week or so to get the information back to you, but I'll find out.
Very fine, Joe. We'll be looking forward to that. I suspect they may have done it the same way. And when it comes to the very long delay in the display of the bars versus a person's hand over the antenna, up till now I thought there's a big integration factor taking place in the client radio. Quite possibly the integration factor is really happening at the cell site.
It's a delay time.
K2YO.
Okay, Wesley recognized Bernie. Bernie, you probably have heard people discussing the subject, K2YO. Tell us what's going on here, Bernie.
Well, I was just going to comment on, you asked if all the vendors were doing it the same way, and we know for a fact on AT&T that's not true, because last week Apple came out and acknowledged they had a bug in their software in calculating the number of bars and said that the iPhones have always been wrong.
Okay, I see a possible dual interpretation of that one, Bernie. Number one, the actual cell-to-client communication link that I'm calling the downlink, it maybe represents that signal strength in some digital code. Then that digital code is in the client radio converted into an algorithm that represents some number of bars. So even though it might be uplink signal strength above threshold, set threshold at the cell site, that really is the raw data which is being sent in the downlink from the cell site. Still, how it's displayed, I'm of the opinion that the cell site is not telling the client radio how many bars to display. It's just giving some kind of a digital code representing uplink signal strength above threshold, and therefore the client radio has to decide by its algorithm how it's going to display that information. I wonder if you see a possible, that being a possible explanation. K2 Yankee Oscar, K2RIW on the TechNet.
Yes, absolutely. Based on the press release that Apple put out, it implied they had to do some figuring, some processing to calculate what to display. If they were just being sent a digital number 6 and they weren't displaying 6 correctly, that would be kind of silly. But if they implied that they had to do some work to the information to be able to calculate how many bars to show and then show the bars, and they said that their calculation was, there was an error in it.
It'd be cool if somebody could write an app to say the actual DBM.
Yeah, I suspect that the downlink signal strength command from the cell site, based on uplink decibels above threshold, is a very coarse reading. What makes me say that is the data stream, it is my belief, it's book solid. Its highest priority is telling the client radio, go up a dB, go down a dB, and on some of the systems, that command is being issued 700 times per second. So as you're driving along in your automobile, using your hands-free radio in order to be legal in New York State, and the signal strength is going up and down by the picket fencing phenomenon, to some degree, I believe the system is trying to follow that that picket fencing up and down in amplitude to try to make everything work correctly. Let's see if Joe agrees with what I just said. W2RYY, K2RIW on the TechNet.
I don't know if that's actually true or not, but they actually makes your phone go up and down that that phantom signal strength. What it's doing is taking your signal strength, signal coming in, and it's basically receiving that at two different antennas. All these cell sites use diversity reception. It's taking the bit stream of antenna A input, antenna B input, and summing it together. And then that's how it determines your actual signal strength with another algorithm, internal algorithm, in the base station systems, software. So that's how it gets an idea of how strong you are coming into it. As far as the cell phone not reading the information correctly, the guy may be right. Maybe the processing algorithm within the phone itself can't handle the information correctly. It's doing the wrong kind of calculation. And maybe it makes you think that you see the signal strength from the cell site, because people are going to assume a signal bar higher means you're seeing the signal strength from the cell site better. But that may not be necessarily true. Maybe what I said is correct. But either way, all these phones have a finite range of these things, and, you know, these networks are not really that extremely robust for them, that kind of signal strength. Maybe not out here. In the city, they may possibly be that strong where they don't have any too many gaps where the signal strength is going to be allowed to really drop below 70, 80 dBm as far as the phone sees it. But out here, it leaves to be desired, much to be desired as far as the coverage of some of these networks. They still have plenty of holes.
Comment.
Go right ahead, Wesley.
Okay, by the time that two differential, these two antennas receive the signal, then there is a comparison for the differential signal, and then another signal check comes in from the cell phone and is again measured. And that after that, for the third time, the antenna sends the signal with the bar, inform me the telephone what is the signal strength and what is actually the condition of the communication in terms of the amplitude, and that's why you have this delay. And apart from that, I have also another question, but that would be after you finish with the gentleman. Enjoy.
Yeah, thank you, Wesley, and we'll come back to you in a second, Chuck, in a minute. Joe, when you talked about the two antennas that are being used for receive, there's three possible interpretations of the two antennas. The two antennas could be a MIMO-like spatial diversity system on a particular sector of the cell site. The cell site, many of them have 120 degree sectors that they usually call alpha, bravo, and gamma. Are you saying that there are two antennas in alpha, two antennas in bravo, two antennas in the gamma sector? That's one interpretation. Number two, you could be saying they compare the signal strength between two antennas, like an antenna in alpha and an antenna in bravo sector. Well, the third interpretation is that you're being received by more than one cell site, and the signal strength between the two cell sites is being compared. Of those three possible interpretations of the two antennas in the spatial diversity system, I'm guessing it's most likely the first of the three, but maybe I'm wrong. W2RYY, T2RIW in the TechNet.
Okay, W2RYY here. I think many of the vendors are using a similar antenna type of system is what I'm talking about. Years ago, they used to use a separate single antenna for you know, receive zero, receive one. Speaking with, say, like Verizon. And they were spaced at, you know, so many feet apart. Now the technology has changed where they can use slant polarity and get 45 degree slant right, 45 degree slant left within one antenna. So one antenna has two ports on it, and it accomplishes the same thing. This is especially true at 1950 megahertz. It's very common to see, you know, an antenna used for transmit and an antenna used for receive. The receive antenna just happens to have, you know, two ports on it. They've been doing the same thing with the transmitter side, too. They want to have, you know, more than one transmit antenna on one particular sector. But that's what I was basically talking about, per sector. From how I understand CDMA works, CDMA, you're being received by several cell sites at once. Not only the cell site you're on, but maybe a neighboring cell site, as it tries to do a soft handle. But I'm talking about basically GSM, the technology. You're being received basically on one cell site at a time, one sector on a cell site at a time.
Comment.
Go ahead, Wesley.
Well, actually, triangulation is being done all the time. That's why the telephone knows how to switch to another cell. And the triangulation, actually, or four-angulation, is built into the software. That's what is being done. And the way that the comparison works for the differential system, the signal, it works, especially with the GSM, with comparing the signal from different cells, not from the two antennas of the same site. But that's why it takes so much time, because there is an internal communication between the sites. Back to you.
Yeah, let me ask Joe on that exact subject. Joe, you just told us that you've got a slant right and a slant left. And if there happen to be 45 degrees slant right and slant 45 degrees left, that means the antennas are orthogonal to each other. That gives the ability to find out, is the signal you're listening to, by electronically combining those two antennas, I can get vertical, horizontal, slant right, slant left, clockwise or counterclockwise, circular polarization. Depending on the way the multipath is working and the way I'm moving, any one of those polarimetry techniques could give you a maximization of signal. How much of that is really being done in the way that I just described? Is there polarimetry, is my first question, Joe, be taking place, optimization of polarimetry on instantaneous reception? And second of all, when it comes to the requirement that a cell site must locate you, the client, within some specific accuracy on the planet Earth, just in case there's an emergency and they want to know where you are, is that locating done by primarily by triangulation or quadrilateral angulation, let's call it triangulation, or is it bilateration. Are they measuring angle, or are they measuring distance between multiple sites, or a combination? W2RYY, K2RIW in the TechNet.
I can't speak for the other carriers because I don't have any recent experience with the other carriers, but I do know with the one carrier I worked with, GSM Technology, they had another piggyback system that was put into the system that received, it had a receiver in it that was able to, actually three receivers that were able to look at each particular face of the cell site, alpha, beta, and gamma. That's all it had to see to be able to pick up your signal, and when it got a 911 incoming from your particular phone, that receiver would look at your particular exact frequency and time slot you were using, and that would be relayed to the switch, and the switch would tell the other receivers and the other surrounding cell sites, okay, you go to this frequency and this time slot, and you look for this guy, and you measure the time difference between where this guy is and how many microseconds and nanoseconds you see him compared to how other cell sites see him. That's basically how I understand how they're doing it currently.
You've just confirmed what I thought. In other words, the arranging between the various cell sites and the client, and I'm calling that trilateration as opposed to triangulation, and that makes some sense, because in a multipath environment, the RF apparent angle of arrival can be heavily distorted by woods, a building, a water tower, telephone wires, and whatever. Angles can really be disturbed, something fierce. But if you're at a particular location, if I'm 1 mile from cell site A and 3 miles from cell site B, and you know approximately which one of the sectors are receiving me, alpha, beta, and gamma, at each of those sites, and you know the number of nanoseconds, which is range, now you've pinned the guy down to some small number of feet. That makes a lot more sense. So I'm being led to believe that the majority of the accurate locating for a 911 call is done by trilateration, more likely than triangulation.
The triangulation is with the direct antennas, directivity of the antennas, so that cannot take place.
Well, if there really were two antennas side by side as an interferometer in each individual sector of the cell site, and some of the older cell sites did use that technique, by interferometry I can now get some fairly accurate angle if there's only one direction of arrival. But you're going to get with multipath, multiple directions of arrival, and I think the angular information is subject to a lot of errors, whereas the ranging information, I think, is a lot more accurate. I wonder if you agree with that one, Joe. W2RYY, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Okay, from where, and it's been many years since I've been out of that particular industry, but what I remember of the equipment that was installed in the base station, it was put in piggyback on all these stations because they had to get the stuff up and running in a very, very short amount of time, like about maybe 6 months or a year. They had a very short time frame to be able to do all this kind of stuff. The receivers they put in were able to hook to the diversity of each particular face. They would have two diversity inputs from each particular face, like receive zero, receive one. It would have that information available on all three faces and have a separate GPS antenna installed at the site, so it knew where it was location-wise by being able to see, so many birds up there. And then it was hooked into the T1, was given a 1DS0 slot designated for itself, and that's how it got its connection back to the switch. And all the stuff was tied into a separate switch that would handle it. So when a 911 call come in, you'd have separate processing. It had nothing to do with the signaling of the base station itself as far as like normal processing calls. There's a separate, completely separate equipment that was running a piggyback. It would do, the cell site would be able to do its normal thing while the stuff was operating, because it was operating as a separate ride-along system. Does that help you as far as understanding how the thing basically works?
I disagree.
We're going to go over to you in a minute, Wesley. What's your best guess, Joe, as to the locating accuracy? Can it locate the person within the nearest 2,000 feet, so to speak? Over to you, Joe.
I don't know if they made refinements in the equipment, because I said I've been out of that particular type of work for a number of years now, so I really can't say. But when I was involved with it, the stuff was probably good to about somewhere around maybe 1,000 feet or so. I don't think they had really too much accuracy, better than 1,000 feet type of accuracy with the system, the way they had the stuff put out. They might have something better now. I don't know.
Yeah, 1,000 feet represents a microsecond of time delay in one direction, and I suspect they can do better than that. Okay, Wesley, I think you had a series of questions. N2XJN, K2RIW on the TechNet.
Yeah, his first comment was that it's first by law. Most of the telephones, they don't have the GPS on, and by the time it was activated, which actually cannot be activated without the knowledge or awareness of the owner of the telephone, because it's against the law, even though that it's being used for 911. At that point, there is a time needed for gathering the information from the satellite, so that could not happen. Let me drop. The second thing is the Doppler effect that actually is being employed. If I could call it Doppler effect, actually, it is the signal from three cells, let's say, and it's this first signal sent, the second signal sent, and it is the comparison factor between the signals, and then this time delay between these two signals compared to the three times data and the communication between them gives you the location. Back to you. Correct me if I'm wrong, and to actually...
We went way off the subject again.
Okay, well, we're coming back. Hang in there. I know. We had some other people with some other questions, and we wanted to pick up Joe. That's how this all got started. To my knowledge, from what I'm hearing, Leslie, I'm pretty sure ranging is done by time between multiple cell sites, and I call that trilateration as opposed to triangulation as far as locating. And I suspect there's a specification of something like 1,000 feet or better that in an emergency situation you must know where the cell site client is, cell phone client is. The original question, of course, was how much taper is going to increase bandwidth of a vertical monopole-like antenna. My experience says not much. I wonder what your experience is on that one, Mel. K2KEY, K2RIW in the TechNet.
I'm sorry, I didn't give you my question. You said I had a question.
Yeah, we better pick up Mel first, and then we're going to come back. Go ahead, Mel.
Okay, this is K2KEY. We've got to stick to this subject. If anyone wants to break in and ask a question, we got to put them on a list, because this is ridiculous. You know, I'm getting inundated here with these comments that it's abstract. We talk about one thing and we go completely at a tangent. So where was I? So anyhow, please, if you want to be put on the list, put on the list and wait for your turn when we get to you. And if you're going to want to make a comment, it's got to be apropos to what we are discussing at this moment. All right? Is that good enough, Dick, or am I overstepping? Over.
We're going to try, Mel. You know that we occasionally compromise. This is a fairly unruly group. And I can give you a bigger whip, and I can use a big whip, and it's only going to help a little bit. But go ahead with what you believe are the hottest subjects right now, Mel. K2KEY, K2RIW.
Echo Sugar.
Okay, I'll try again. This is K2KEY. We were discussing pipe and tape. So let me boil this down so that I don't get questions, because they said they don't understand, there's so many of them come in with the same question. If they are using a certain length of pipe and they use the chart that basically outlines the I guess the maximum diameter that it starts with, they don't have in it any taper ratios. I believe there is formulas if you want to figure taper ratio in what they call ratio to diameter, to length. I don't know. That's what I'm asking. Is it a factor in, for instance, if you're doing some experiments, say you, like you brought up at 40 meters, would it be a factor, or can you just ignore that, Dick? Over.
If I started off with a large diameter pipe or a small diameter pipe and I made the whole antenna that diameter, or if I started off with a large diameter type and tapered to a smaller diameter near the tips of the antenna at a particular rate, as I experiment with tapering, of those two different kinds of tapering that I just mentioned, the first thing that will happen is that the electronic length will change. In other words, if I tune the antenna with a particular diameter at 14.2 megacycles, we'll say, and I use some other diameter, the center frequency of the best standing wave ratio may go to 14.15. So it is my belief that as you change taper and taper ratio, you're going to deviate somewhat on electrical length. That's the first thing you're going to see. And up until now, I was worried about how much change in bandwidth. I think that's going to be a much smaller factor. But I think tuning of center frequency versus taper, I think that's a major factor. It's a considerable factor. That's my recollection of the Brown and Woodward curves. That may be also your recollection of these graphs and charts that we've seen for taper ratios versus the right length for an element that's on a Yagi or a ground plane antenna. I wonder if that sort of goes along with what you're familiar with, Mel. K2KEY, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Well, as far as, like I say, Jerry Civic, he did not mention, you know, what the effect was going from his television mask to a 8-foot length of stainless steel rod that had a mobile antenna. The point is that if you are doing this experiment, should they be concerned? Is it going to make such a difference then in the matching network? Or is it, for instance, not really a significant factor, say, on HF, say, somewhere in the neighborhood of doing this from, say, antennas usually maybe from 20 to 20 meters, 15, 20, maybe 40 meters, Dick, because, or even 80 meters. I doubt if you're going to get a very effective radiator if you're going to work with one of these four shortened pieces of pipe, as is mentioned in a number of these articles. But the point is that just whether or not the taper factor is going to make the big difference, or you think at HF it makes, in other words, minor difference. Go ahead.
I'm going to say something in between there, Mel. I'm still of the belief that you choose the diameter of your construction for mechanical reasons. Now, let's assume that I'm homebrewing an antenna. And if this was the best of all worlds, and it almost never happens, if somebody gave me an extremely well-tested, robust, well-documented design, and I'm using the exact materials, and the material, the design says, start off with a 2-inch diameter pipe, go downrange for X number of feet, taper it down to 1 3/4-inch diameter pipe, go X number of feet, and so on. And if I'm using the exact matching network, the exact components, the exact diameters, then yes, duplicating his results is an important thing if I want to have the least amount of grief when I build this antenna. However, but let me give you another side of this. Almost and none of us, when we're building an antenna, is it that well documented. We're given some vague information that start off with approximately this diameter, set it approximately this length, and use this approximate impedance matching network. When you and I build it with our particular materials, with rare exception, when we sweep the antenna and measure the standing wave ratio, and we look at that U-shaped curve of standing wave ratio versus frequency. The bottom of the U-shaped curve, the best place for the standing wave ratio, is most likely not going to fall on our favorite frequency. Any